I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast.
The year is 1967. The artist, Flip Wilson, the album, Cowboys and Colored People, and my guest, Ramesh Ranganathan. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This is super fun.
Let's. I don't always do this, but let's get the promotional thing out of the way, and we'll talk about it at the end.
Okay. I'm doing a show at the Greek Theatre on the 21st of December. Please come.
Easy enough.
Yeah.
So you're here the whole time just promoting that show?
Pretty much, yeah. I've sort of come over here and I'm gigging and doing bits and pieces, but yeah, that's basically it.
That's so much fun.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm super excited. I honest to God had no idea Flip Wilson crossed the water so well. I had no idea because this is the first, by the way, no one's ever said cross the water. But yeah, I love this album. I've owned it for a long time, but this is the first time I've listened to it.
Yes. Well, the truth is I only listened to it a while ago for the first time. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't want you to be under the impression that I have listened to this album a lot.
Sure.
What happened was, I'll tell you exactly the sort of how it came about that I even sort of became aware of Flip Wilson, because he hasn't really made his way over the water.
Okay.
To repeat the phrase that you've just coined, which I like.
Shitty, horrible phrase, yeah.
But basically what happened was is that I am a massive fan of Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a channel, Sky, in the UK, mm-hmm. who've just done a series called Passions, where they ask different people to pick anything they like. So it could be ice cream, or it could be mm-hmm. an artist, or it could be a musician, or whoever, and talk about them for the documentary, do a documentary about them. So
amazing.
I came out to LA to talk about Richard Pryor, to look into Richard Pryor and what made him a genius, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, on the first or second day of filming, I spoke to a guy that was a Richard Pryor fan, and he started saying to me, well, you must be a fan of Flip Wilson if you like Richard Pryor. And I said, no.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, well, why not? You can't be into Pryor if you're not into Flip Wilson. And then,
interesting.
Now that was his thing. Nobody else said that.
I've never heard that before myself, but yeah.
So, but it did intrigue me. And then everybody else, loads of people I spoke to after that sort of started going on about Flip Wilson and how I should check him out. And so I did. And that's sort of how it's come to be that we're talking about him today. I mean, I don't know how much you know about the UK comedy scene.
Enough, but not up to date.
But like, I think there's a difference between, the main difference I'd say between American stand-up and British stand-up, or something that I really admire about American stand-up, and part of the reason I love Pryor so much, and part of the reason I've sort of grown to be a big fan of Flip Wilson, is that comedians in Britain, we're sort of so set up punch in such an explicit way. It's sort of, you know, you want to strip the fat down from the jokes and what you're talking about.
Sure.
So you go, and sometimes I think that can be to the detriment of what you're talking about. You want to take out anything extraneous and you want to just get to the thing. And I know a lot of American comics do that. But it feels like, somebody described it to me, like British comedy is like set up punch, whereas American comedy, it feels a bit more, when the best people are doing it,
mm-hmm.
it feels a bit like jazz, do you know, in terms of like, they're sort of talking around different topics and things like that, in a gentle way, and you sometimes don't know where the punchlines are, or you don't see what's happening.
Sure.
And I think that's the case with him. Do
absolutely,
you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I that was exactly what I was noticing listening to it. Would you have picked, so if you didn't know about Flip Wilson now, would you probably pick Richard Pryor today otherwise?
What, as my, yes, probably. But yeah. I tell you the reason I didn't pick Richard Pryor is because I thought I thought that you would have talked about him loads.
Mm-hmm.
And
not enough, but.
Oh, right, okay. And secondly, I just felt like it would be good to talk about somebody that isn't talked about as much, I think.
Absolutely, even over here.
Yeah, so that's the kind of reason I went for it.
Yeah, in 250 episodes, one person has picked it.
Right, okay.
And picked the only one that won a Grammy, even though this is the album that got him a TV career. This is the album that made him,
So, arguably. But isn't it one particular routine from
this? The Columbus routine.
Right.
Which is so ridiculous, but so good.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the problem I'm having, of course, in 2017, going back 50 years, is I've heard plenty of people do a conversational version of history since then. But it's not like that was, everybody was doing it.
Yes, I know. And but that's the thing that sort of, well, two things. I think he's got a similar quality to Pryor in terms of he seems pretty fearless.
Yes.
And I would argue that what I would say is that if I was asking someone to listen to this album and recommending it to them, I would ask them very much to appreciate the context that the album was recorded in and the time it was recorded in, because I mean, if I, for example, I sometimes show comedians to my wife and say, like, check this out. I don't think I would do this with Flip Wilson particularly, like, just because she'd go, I don't get, this is really brutal, or like, you know, this is pretty full on. So I would ask people to bear that in mind, but it is just brilliant and fearless stuff. And it, like you said, that Christopher Columbus routine, I guess if I heard somebody doing it now, it would still be very good.
Of course.
But you'd go, okay, I sort of get it. And like you said, it's been done a lot. But for the time, it's pretty amazing.
It's wonderful. And I mean, with, like I said, 67. So we're dead center in the middle of the civil rights movement. We've got a guy who's, he's, what's interesting is he seems to have this, his image is fairly family friendly because he had a variety show. So hearing him swear at all shocks me every time.
Yeah. Yes.
He barely swears, by the way. He says ass maybe at the most.
Yes. But it still is, I don't know, it's context is everything, isn't it, I guess?
Absolutely,
but,
yeah.
But like, I remember like a friend of mine went to see, forgive me, forget, Ray Romano, who, the comedian that plays his brother.
Brad Garrett, thank you.
Brad Garrett, right. Mm-hmm. So Brad Garrett, my friend went to see both of them. I think Brad Garrett was doing a show at Vegas. And Brad Garrett is very rude in his stand-up. And my friend said it was the most incredible thing that he'd ever seen, because he'd only, the only experience he had was watching him in the sitcom. And then as soon as he swore, he said he could have heard him. Are we allowed to swear on this podcast?
Oh, yeah.
But if he'd have just said fuck for an hour, he said he would have loved it.
Just based on expectation.
Yes, basically,
sheer expectation. That's amazing. Yeah, that's, well, and that's what's funny to me is like that a guy like this has to barely tone himself down. It's so, you know, it's not like he became a toothless performer or anything, but it is, I liked being able to hear what he sounds like in what seems like a pretty small club or series of clubs. Very small, sounds like to me.
Yes. And I sort of think like, well, you sort of think about the time it was done. I think the thing about this album is, I don't know what you thought, but I didn't feel like it always sounded like he was smashing the gig. Do you know what I mean? Mm-mm. It didn't feel like he was killing it the whole time.
Right. It felt like he was, I don't want to say trying things out, but definitely like just putting out all the material and seeing where it lands. Not necessarily picking the best takes.
And
or,
he sort
I don't
of,
know.
He sort of had, I mean, there's a lot of ideas in this album. But it just didn't, like, you sort of listen to it. There's no way that would have been allowed now for him to have that gig and that would be committed to. They would have gone, we're going to have to do another five nights of this.
Sure, sure.
And get it to a point where you can get it, where you, where it's good.
Tweak it, make the laughs work in spots where it wasn't
exactly,
working before.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
So, but I think it's better for that, to be honest with you. I sort of, you sort of, I don't know, you feel like you're making up your own mind about the stuff, do you know what I mean? Rather than being told by an audience what to laugh at and what to, not to laugh at.
For sure.
And we as British, like, for example, well, as British comedy fans, we the stereotype about American audiences is that they go mad for anything.
Sure.
Not go mad for anything. That's an exaggeration. I don't want to insult your listeners.
No, I know what you mean.
But, like, they go wild and crazy, and sometimes that ruins it. But I, but that this is not the case with this. I mean, it's just a guy being pretty raw, and just sort of, it's very ideas-based comedy, and that's what I found so fascinating about it.
It's actually a good comparison to, a couple weeks ago we did Are You Serious by Richard Pryor, which was one that I didn't even know the history of before we recorded, but it was one that he recorded before he got super famous, released after he was super famous. In fact, they literally like pasted the Silver Streak train on the cover just so people would, hey, it's that guy. And it's really fun to listen to because it's kind of half and half. It's so weird to listen to somebody who you know has been at the top of their game, like even Richard Pryor level.
Yeah.
And to listen to people just like, again, like you say, make up your mind about what's fun and what's funny and what isn't.
Yeah, and I do, I did find myself listening to this and being quite jealous, I guess, because one, it was a different time, and it felt like you could be shocking, but there was not a problem with that. Or, you know, you could push the boundaries. But the other thing I think about Flip Wilson, for those people that haven't listened to him or watched any of his stuff, is that he has got, he had all the ingredients that it takes to just be funny all the time. And, and what I mean by that is he looks funny, his physicality is funny, his voice is funny. And so you'll sort of listen to his stuff, and that's not to say the writing is not great on this album. It is really good. It's patchy. I would argue there are weak points in the album. For example, I wasn't a fan of the Cheap Hotel routine particularly. But you still... you still laugh at it because his voice is, like, his voice is hilarious. Like, everything about him is funny. And I was sort of listening to it thinking, I wish I had that because I don't have that. I mean, you can tell you've been speaking to me for a while, and if anything, my voice isn't interesting, let alone funny. So so it's sort of, you find yourself as a comedian being very, I sort of found myself being very envious of him.
I mean, obvious. There is the obvious connection, however, that you are in America, and some of us, I won't say who, myself, instinctively will gravitate towards certain voices. So you have you have that benefit, if only because of just the fact that you have a different voice. I mean, like, that is going to happen.
Yeah.
So, I know what you're saying, though. I whenever he does a woman's voice, it's so stupid. But I mean, it's the silliest and goofiest thing, but I kind of really like it. I mean, he did a whole album as that.
Well, he did do a whole album as that. And what also is true about him is that all of the, there are no difference between any of the women.
Mm-mm, not a bit.
And it's, he basically, I guess, I imagine, practiced an impression of a woman and thought, okay, I've got that.
Yeah.
And then thought, anytime I ever write another routine about a woman, I have got that voice. And it doesn't matter if that woman's Guatemalan or Indian or Indonesian, she's going to have that voice.
Or if she's the Queen of Spain. they all sound like Geraldine.
Yeah.
That is it. And he won an Oscar. He won a Grammy for the Geraldine album, too, should be pointed out. This is his, I think, third album. Somebody's going to tell me I'm wrong about this, but I think this is his third album.
Did this come out before or after Geraldine?
Yeah, almost certain it's before. Let me just double check. Yeah, it's two before. Although I think the next one, if I'm not mistaken, is also a Geraldine album, actually, because I'm thinking The Devil Made Me Buy This Dress, which is the Grammy winner. I'm assuming The Devil You, because the word devil is so often used when he's Geraldine. I'm assuming the next one is also at least partially a Geraldine album.
What do you know about his history, if anything?
I don't know nearly enough. I was trying to pull it up on Wikipedia earlier, and it's one of those things where somebody picks it, and I'm like, oh, I know Flip Wilson, and then realize I know shit about Flip Wilson, other than, again, this album breaking him having a very successful variety show. I have that album, too,
right.
His variety show. But yeah, I really not enough, except for the fact that he was... he was abandoned by his father. All of the kids were put in foster homes, and just out to the wind. The kids.
Yeah,
I
do sort of wish sometimes that had happened to me, because like I do sort of think like I, you know, being a fan of Richard Pryor and his background, and then I sort of listened to Flip Wilson, and I thought, oh, he's really good. I hope that he went to a private school and had a really balanced upbringing, and then I found out that, you know, his life was shit as well. And then I found myself sort of thinking, well, how can I be good at comedy? Because my parents weren't like fucked up enough. Do you know what I mean? And like, they did make some mistakes.
Sure.
And that's why I'm now a mid-level comedian. But like, I really feel if they'd gone all out there and like my mum had sort of prostituted herself or something. It sometimes makes me worry that I'm going to make, because I've got three children and it makes me nervous that I am going to basically, they're going to be mediocre human beings because you strive to do the right thing by your kids.
Right.
But what I'm doing, I've got three children and I'm basically bringing up three very average human beings. I sort of feel like partly what I should do is just abandon them just for a bit, just to sort of really see if they've got any creativity in them. Do you know what I mean? Like maybe like leave them in the woods for a bit or something like that.
Yeah.
And then come back to them. And if they haven't got anything, then that's fine. At least we tried.
Absolutely. I mean, otherwise, you're like you said, they're going to be mediocre, but think they're the best thing in the world.
Exactly.
If they're abandoned, they'll at least think they're shit.
Yes, exactly. And then you've got to overcome that. And also, I think you give people a good story. Like, and what I mean by that is, I don't just mean a good story in itself. What I mean is, like, you know, if you're a massive alcoholic and then you overcome alcoholism And then people go, oh, isn't it great? He's like holding down a job. But if you weren't an alcoholic before that, nobody gives a shit that you're holding down a job.
Right.
This is an expected thing. So you sort of think what you're doing is you're giving them the gift of low expectations. Uh-huh. Do you know what I mean?
I do, yeah.
And I wonder, basically, Richard Price started me on that way of thinking and Flip Wilson furthered me down it. And now I sort of like, cause my mum's out here in LA with me at the moment. And like occasionally I feel angry with her about it. Because like sometimes she'll go to me, oh, how come, for example, how come you're not selling as many tickets as you want? I say to her, well, look, why don't you look a little bit closer to home? If you'd have fucked me over a bit more,
right,
I would have had the raw materials to be better. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I do. What is there a comparison you can draw between Flip Wilson or Richard Pryor and maybe an English comedian or British comedian that people don't know about over here so much? Maybe even me.
Oh, wow, that's a difficult question. I think not performance wise, but I think not even the material's not similar, but just sort of the ideas and the push of an idea and the not caring about offence or anything like that. There's a comedian, Frankie Boyle. Do you know Frankie Boyle?
I know of him. I don't think I know his material.
So Frankie Boyle is just very, very brutal and says what he thinks. And he makes some great political points. And he's a satirist. And he does stuff that is a statement about the politics in the UK and, and things like that. But he's also horrific with it. You know, so it's sort of like he pushes it to its very limit. And I think I probably compare Richard Pryor and to a certain degree Flip Wilson to him, I think. But they don't look anything alike. I mean, people are going to Google Frankie Boyle and see the whitest man on the planet and then wonder why I've done that. But I do think that's probably my closest parallel.
Okay. See, that's I like having recommendations for people. I will make a point, though. You do have a, you mentioned earlier you asked if I put clips in, and I don't anymore. People, honestly, I mean, this is on YouTube. You can find this thing on YouTube. At least listen to the Columbus sketch.
Yes.
Again, because it's the one that people... this is a crazy time, in at least in American comedy, where, oh, I just heard a track on your album. Here's a fucking career. Like, they gave him a career. Like, they handed... Not that he hadn't worked for it, but they handed him this huge opportunity based off of a funny sketch.
Yeah, because he was... I mean, that is basically what... Like, that is... It's literally that moment, isn't it? This, however long this is, 6 minute 50.
Yeah.
That 6 minutes 50 basically elevated him to... It's pretty amazing. I churn out shit all the time.
Of course. Of course you do.
It's not got me there.
It's 2017.
Yeah,
it's that's
true.
The pool
difficult.
That you have to rise above, that you have to appear amongst, like, it's insane.
The thing about that Christopher Columbus routine that I think is, and I don't know if this is the reason why it propelled him to where he's supposed to be, where he ended up being, sorry, is that... I always, whenever I watch routines like that, or listen to routines like that, I always think about, I always sort of reverse engineer what the starting point for that routine was. And it's very obvious with that. But I wonder what it was like the first time that he ever did it, because that requires a big commitment.
For sure.
Right? And so I sort of wonder, I don't know if you've ever had this experience of trying something out and then abandoning it almost immediately because you think it's got nothing. But like...
Yeah. I don't do stand-up, but yes, still.
But, like, for example, you might have tried another podcast, like Comedy on Minidisc or something like that, and then just thought, I'm not gonna do that anymore. But, like, that routine, I just think it just pushes an idea to its absolute extreme limits. And I think that is, for me as a comedian, is fascinating. I sort of think, like, he had to have not had that. He's had a kernel of an idea and then pushed it. And it must have failed. It must have failed many, many times.
Right.
And he's got it to a point where, well, it's done what it's done. He had no idea it's going to do that. But, like, I just think it's, from a writer's point of view, you know, if there are comedians that listen to this, I would say that's an interesting thing to sort of examine and explore.
But also to do it, the idea that that's the final bit is it's so conversational that I don't know, I literally cannot tell you, I couldn't tell you how it was written. If it was written, if it's 100% tried out. But, like, it's so conversational, the idea that you would go from something that was probably still conversational but just a seed of an idea, but then go to still conversational but also polished. I don't understand. Again, I'm not a stand-up.
Yeah, well, I would guess, and this is only based on personal experience, but sure. I would guess that it's all written on stage is mm-hmm. that, you know, he had this idea and he tries the lines and he tries the lines and tries the lines. Because I think that the other thing about him is his punch. It's not that there's no obvious punchlines. It's very funny. I think it's very funny. Mm-hmm. Funnier in certain parts than others, but it's very funny. But you sort of can't see the workings of it throughout the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't go, oh, that's a gag. That's right. a gag. That's a gag. It's just very funny ideas and he's exploring them. And I think, like, I think this is what I guess would have happened is he's just tried it and then kept trying lines. And every time a line lands, he'd literally scientifically go, that's staying in or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Until he got to a point where he's got the finished article. And it looks, like you said, it still looks like a conversation because it was a conversation. It was a conversation that he was playing out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that he didn't know where it was going to go. And there must have been nights where he did that whole conversation and he got nothing.
Right.
And so he's just gone, okay, but I still think it's funny and I'm going to keep pushing it. And eventually got to where it was. And he probably listened to it after that and thought, oh, there's a missed opportunity for a gag there or mm-hmm. that bit lags or whatever. So I think it's very interesting for that.
Listening to it, I was also doing the same thing, trying to figure out what's the root of... the root of the idea is obvious, but what... Like, what's the first joke he had in mind? It sounds to me like you were listening to it and you broke it down. You might have a better idea of where you think he started. Do you think, is there like one joke that's the most obvious to you that just feels like, oh no, this is like, what if this happened and I could extend from there? Or is it just simply, I've just placed my personality over this one historical concept? It's interesting.
I honestly believe he will have just been... I think he will have just been having a chat with somebody about Christopher Columbus.
Okay, yeah.
And said, do you not think... blah, and then that gave him the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's turned that into a thing. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I have... And by the way, this routine that I'm about to talk about is nowhere near as good as his routine. And I don't want anybody to go, you're comparing your crap to Flip Wilson's... But I did a thing. I do a thing where I talk about teaching my child to read,
mm-hmm.
and I talk about how frustrating it is.
Uh-huh.
But the whole routine is me having a conversation with my son about him reading, and the start of that was that I was teaching my son to read, and then I came downstairs, and I said to my wife, "This is really annoying. Teaching Theo to read is really doing my head in, like because he's not trying hard enough." And I get worried. I get anxious as a parent about him not trying hard enough. And so, I thought I can do that as a routine. But I just felt like it was much funnier to act it out
mm-hmm.
than to explain, isn't it annoying when you're trying to, it's annoying when you're trying to teach your child to read. So that's my guess.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. When you are at your most performative.
Yeah.
What are you using? Because this guy is clearly like he's got, I mean, it's the time he's going to have maybe a little more vaudeville in his blood than any American comic would now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm curious what you are drawing from what, again, maybe other influences or, people who, because again, you do have a very stoic presence on stage, but I will, you know, if you smile, it's for a point.
Yeah.
If it's making a face or a voice, it's for, you've got a very solid reason for doing it.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, I don't know, like, because are you naturally introverted and pulling a face is like work? I'm curious for you.
That's a really interesting question. I think probably, well, the truth is that because what people say to me is that people tend to say to me that I'm less polite and nice on stage than I am off stage.
Okay.
But my argument would be that how I'm on stage is how I'd ideally like to be. It's my fantasy of, you know, I take the filters off and I can do what I want.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, like, I very rarely write bits word for word.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm writing, I think of a starting point, like an idea. And then I think of everything I think that's interesting about that idea. So I don't try and be funny. I just think about what's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Get all of that down. And then I just go to a club that night and talk it out and try and find the funny in it.
Mm-hmm.
And what you find is the audience sort of give you a laugh and you go, okay, that's a good area. And then you keep talking in that area. And then what will happen is you'll say something and you'll do a face to emphasize that thing just because that's your natural reaction mm-hmm. to doing that. and then that might get a laugh, or you do a voice to make a point, and that might get a laugh, and then you make a decision about whether that's going to stay in forever or whether that's in the moment. There's been loads of times when I've said something off the cuff, and it's got like a big laugh, and then I've gone, "Holy shit, Rom, you've just struck gold," and then it's played to silence every other single time I've done it. So it's sort of like you sort of have to keep working on it and pushing it. But for me, that's why I find something like Flip Wilson so interesting, and Richard Pryor, is because I don't write down gags. I just don't write down jokes. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to believe, I don't know how what Flip Wilson's writing process was, but the result to me feels like somebody that didn't go, "I'm going to write this joke." They went, "I've got this idea and I'm going to figure it out."
Yeah.
And that's why the stand-up, the results sound so conversational. Like, we've all seen stand-ups where it goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Sure. And it's fine and it's good, and I've got no issue with that. But I get turned on myself as a comedy fan by people for whom I can't see the workings or I can't figure it out. And I'm not saying that's true for the whole album.
Sure.
But what I am saying is, just generally, his comedy, I felt like you were laughing at points and you sort of didn't know, I didn't know what he thought I was going to laugh at. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
I don't know what he thought the punchline was.
Right.
But I was laughing. So you go, that feels like something where he's just felt it out rather than written it down in a scientific way. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And it doesn't feel as, because you can still sound conversational, but be deliberate sounding, where it's like he or she is very good at performing conversationally or very naturally, but also still has the rhythms we're used to. Whereas I don't know necessarily that those are typical comedy rhythms. I'd have to listen to it again a few times to say that confidently. But.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm sure now that we've had that conversation, you and I will go away and listen to it and go, "Well, it's absolutely, I mean, this is the structure."
Mm-hmm.
It goes 1, 2, 3, 1 or whatever. Sure. Do you know what I mean? That'll happen. Of course it'll happen.
Absolutely.
And I apologize to people if you discover that, please don't tweet me. But certainly I'd say on as a casual listen, it's very, very disguised and poetic's the wrong word, but I just think it flows really nicely.
Mm-hmm. How many times have you heard it now? I mean, I do like that you haven't heard it a million times. It's actually,
I haven't heard it that much at all, really. Yeah. Like, I've listened to it maybe, I listened to it before I came here.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to it I listened to everything as much as I could find of his after I spoke to the guy in LA that had a go at me for not having listened to it. So maybe like a handful of times, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love that. Does it feel like something that you want to keep listening to? And it sounds like it, but I mean, I don't want to assume.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, I definitely. And I think that, like, there are certain albums that, or certain specials or shows or whatever you want to call it, that you really enjoyed at the time and you still think are brilliant, but you would not go back to.
Absolutely.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
Whatever reason that is, they've just dated not very well, or they'd say some stuff that's really horrendous and horrific.
Sure.
Which we've all experienced. But yeah, I would go back to this, definitely. 100%. I think it's, I mean, I would go back to it as a comedian. Do you know what I mean? And I would love to, not too easily, but I'd love to unlock the formula and just sort of go, okay, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that'll happen.
You know what's interesting is every time I have a stand-up on here, there's always one thing. They're not necessarily uncomfortable with this part of their own act or their own personality, but they always have a thing like, "I wish I could do such and such like this person." I'm curious, like, can you whittle it down to the one thing about Flip Wilson that you wish you could maybe pull out of your own act more? Not to say that your act isn't good or that people shouldn't go see you at the Greek, because people should absolutely go see you at the Greek in December. But I'm saying,
What I think is, if I'm being honest, is I think that Flip Wilson, I think he was an infinitely better performer than I am. If I'm being brutally honest, in terms of his delivery and in terms of his cadence and in terms of, there's an intangible thing in the way that he delivers stuff in his voice and the tone of his voice that is inherently funny that I don't have. I do believe that, like, there are certain comedians that you could listen to talk about anything,
mm-hmm.
and it would be funny. And I don't think I'm one of those people. I think I can be funny if I'm trying to be funny, I guess, or mm-hmm. if I'm expressing an idea. But nobody, like, for example, these sentences I've said, I've not said anything funny for the last 2 minutes. Whereas arguably, if Flip Wilson was saying what I was saying now, uh-huh. it would be funny because uh-huh. of his voice and the way he delivers stuff and just the general thing. And I don't think I can achieve that unless I deliberately try and start putting on a funny voice.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I'm not prepared to do. So I guess I'm trapped. I'm trapped as I am.
There's so many comics like that, though. I mean, like, I've got some of them on the... Most of the guys on the wall, and women, let's be honest, it's all men except for one, and that's horrible. But so many of these people... I mean, if you listen to some people in conversation, though, reportedly... and this is no comparison, Christopher Guest is the dullest interview on the planet. And I find him to be brilliant, but he's apparently just very dull in person and he knows it. Like, right. dull. Not funny. Yeah. Dull as hell.
Right, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he knows it, and he thinks that of himself. That could also be part of the reason he comes across that way to other people. But, I mean, it's so funny to me when Bob Newhart, I would bet, I'm assuming would be a very funny interview, but he's also like a super planned performer. I don't think he deviated much.
Yeah, and I know, and I think that there are comedians that I know, without naming names, uh-huh. who are brilliant on stage,
mm-hmm.
But it's learned. Mm-hmm. Everything's learned. And sure. so when you speak to them off stage, I like to think I can tell if somebody's going to be really funny on stage just by talking, even if they don't make me laugh.
Yeah.
I feel like there's like a different way of looking at things, or they've got something about them that you can tell. But I have met comedians who do brilliantly on stage, and a lot of them do great on TV and stuff,
mm-hmm.
who you just wouldn't pick off stage. They're just yeah. like, just very, very sort of dry, and not dry in a humorous way, I mean just mm-hmm. dry guys. There's no dry, and there's nothing wrong with that, but there are other people who you share a dressing room with
mm-hmm.
and you can't stop laughing, or they're just right. on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is annoying. I mean, it can be. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I think it's... Some people just have it. Like, for example, I think if to name somebody very mainstream, like you look at someone like Kevin Hart, for uh-huh. example, you know, you can... You know, people talk about him as an act because he's so massive and they mm-hmm. sort of break it down and stuff, but there's no denying that he's just hilarious to look at and listen to.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? And so yeah. you feel like if you sat him in here and got him to just describe the room that we're sitting
oh
in
God,
now,
of course, yeah,
he would kill. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Whereas if you got me to do that, well, I'm not even going to start because I don't want a massive drop off on the podcast. But.
Well, Kevin Hart's actually, it's a good example of a guy who I haven't seen his act, but it's mostly because I don't know if I need to for that exact reason.
Yeah.
I can see him do a guest spot on a thing and he tears it up. And normally, I actually don't care for that type of personality. It's like, okay, calm the fuck down.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but he's a rare exception to that rule for
me. But with Kevin Hart, and I think that's the difference between like someone like Flip Wilson and Kevin mm-hmm. Hart. I know Flip Wilson did the voices and stuff sure. like that, but it didn't ever feel like he was, for me, uh-huh. it didn't feel like he was ever trying too
Absolutely.
Hard.
Absolutely.
And that's sort of what I find so appealing about him.
Mm-hmm.
For me, if somebody's really trying hard to be funny,
mm-hmm.
it's one of the least funny things you can, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it never, but the thing is, it seems ridiculous to say that because when you listen to it, he's got voices and he pushes it out and his performances,
mm-hmm.
but it just doesn't ever feel like he's really, really trying.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, is the magic of it.
It's still so rooted in the storytelling of each joke.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's rough to get right.
Yeah, yeah.
In any way. You know, for a second, I was about to ask you the dumbest thing. Like, hey, can you name some English acts who are too over the top and shitty? Like, I was really about to ask you to just set yourself up.
Because I've got some in
mind. Exactly, right. Because I've got some in mind. But, you know, we can all agree that Are You Being Served isn't that great, right? Can we, like, that's one of those things that comes over here. And Americans think they can connect to an English person by saying, hey, I've seen Are You Being Served.
Yeah.
It's legitimately one of the... Because PBS tells us this is what English people like. That's what happens.
Right.
You understand?
Yeah.
And I have parents who lived in England, and they still fell for it. We still fell for the same thing.
And I didn't know that. I didn't know that was a phenomenon.
Yeah. But we lucked out with Monty Python, I think, although I do think there are plenty of English people who maybe would just be like, would you please also stop talking about Monty Python?
Oh, I can tell you that there are lots of mm-hmm. English people that think that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember watching, the films, the Monty Python film. Mm-hmm. I didn't really watch much of the TV show.
Yeah.
But I watched the films, Life of Brian, and I thought they were really funny.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I heard, and this sounds really bad, I mean, God, Monty Python are great, but mm-hmm. I was surprised by how exalted they are over here. I mean, it was, I just didn't know. I just didn't know.
And then interesting.
It's incredible.
The fucking gods, and it's very weird to nerds.
Yeah.
To a bunch of guys, the thing is, I've gotten some very interesting reactions from people, not too much vitriol, but their comedy albums are a million times better than the TV show. And I love the show, but their comedy albums are brilliant. It's one of the reasons I do this show.
Yeah.
I don't know about that one, actually. The one that's on the wall is just because that's recognizably Python. But,
right.
That's interesting. I'd wondered that exact same thing, because every time I've had anybody who's English on the show, Python's never come up. You know, they don't say, let's talk about Monty Python, except for I interviewed the guy who produced all the Python albums. So that's about it.
The one thing I would say, well, I don't know if you've watched any of John Cleese's talks or anything on YouTube or anything like that.
Maybe. I remember he was a little pro-Brexit there for a second, so I ignored
Yeah. I mean, no, I haven't watched any of his pro-Brexit stuff, but he did do, for a while, he did a few talks about the art of creativity
mm-hmm.
and how to be creative and how to write stuff and mm-hmm. how to come up with truly great stuff.
Do Schweppes commercials.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was number two on his list of things.
Uh-huh.
But the one thing he said was, he didn't name who it was, but he said there was somebody else, mm-hmm. I assume one of the other Pythons.
Uh-huh.
He said that he thought was more talented than him,
uh-huh.
But that wrote worse stuff than him. So,
interesting.
So he said that, We'd come up with scripts and we'd go off and write separate scripts. And he goes, he's very matter of fact about it. He goes, and my scripts are always better than his. So, despite the fact he's much more talented than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and it puzzled me. I mean, I don't know if this is arrogance or self-deprecation. I can't figure it out, but it's arrogance, isn't it?
It's both.
Yeah.
It's 100% both.
And he said, I tried to figure out why it was. And he said, I think it's just because I spend more time on it. And that sounds a very obvious thing to say, but what he said was like, he'll come up with a solution. Like, when you write a scene, it's like, this is getting very wanky now, but I've started.
That's what this podcast is.
Okay, cool. So he'll write a scene, and when you write a comedy scene, it's like a puzzle, and you're trying to find the solution to that, and there's sort of a mathematical element to it. You're trying to think, what is the out here, or where does this go? And you can spend lots of time racking your brains over it. And he said that his friend, whoever that was, who mm-hmm. didn't even allude to who it might be, would always, as soon as they found a solution, accept that as a solution for the thing.
Yeah.
Whereas he would go, I've got my first solution, and I'm going to reject that now
mm-hmm.
and look for another one. And he believed that if you do that every single time, that's why he came up with stuff. The reason I mention all this is very interesting. It's actually quite interesting to listen to him talk about.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. To see that.
He doesn't talk about Monty Python being overrated or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But the TV show, but mm-hmm. I'm sure he might do in a different one.
Right. So we've officially not burned any bridges for you.
No. In fact, cut that last bit out. Oh, okay, sure. Career ender for me.
Mm-hmm, right. Okay. Okay. You know, it's actually interesting. It's not a bad point. I mean, I feel like people who, I hate the word talent. Like, I abhor that word. I really do. I prefer skilled. And I know that people like him will use the word talent because it's one of those things that allows you to feel like it was given to you by God. And that's great. And we all feel special. We all feel precious.
Yeah.
But it is one thing when you are praised for being talented, you definitely do pick the first fucking thing and go with it. The first thing that gets a laugh, you're like, oh, this is everything. Bye. That's all you need to do. And there's something to that. Working on it, honing it.
Yeah, but I do think that, yes, I do think that. And I thought that about my stand-up, actually, in particular, mm-hmm. because I remember, I remember I was writing my second Edinburgh show a few years ago, and I really was struggling to come up with an hour
mm-hmm.
for the festival. And I was writing bits, and I was trying them, and they weren't working, and I was throwing them away, and I was like, okay, let's try and come up with another thing. But then I remember that when I first started doing stand-up, I mm-hmm. had 5 minutes of stuff. And I remember in that first routine, I talked about, to give you an idea of how cutting edge I was, I talked about Mr. T's response to the New Orleans hurricanes, right?
Holy shit.
So that was my whole bit, was about that, right? And I remember thinking back to that, and the first time I did that routine, it died on its ass, right? And the second time I did that routine, it died on its ass. And the third time, basically, that went, it died on its ass for ages, but I kept doing it because I had nothing else. Like, I couldn't think, I was thinking, okay, this is quite fun, I think it's fun. And eventually, I got to a point where that routine was funny, right? And I used it and ended up using it for, like, in new act competitions and stuff like that. But I have never worked on a routine and honed a routine in my life since, as much as I did that Mr. T routine. And the reason is, if a routine doesn't work, I'll tweak it a bit, and if by the third time it doesn't work, it's gone.
Yeah.
So I've never, I started thinking, there could be gold. I mean, there could be amazing routines.
Sure.
There could be my Christopher Columbus.
If you try like it on them 100 more times.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But so, I mean, is there some potential that maybe by the 100th time you've done it, it's so funny to watch you struggle through it and fucking push through it that you're like, I'm going to find this fucking joke or kill myself. Like,
well, there was a routine I had about a tiger escaping from a zoo in Poland. And I wrote a routine about it, and I promise you, I thought it was the best thing that anyone had ever written in comedy, right? So I started doing it, and it never once worked, ever. And I don't even mean people laughed at the setup and they were disappointed with where it went.
Sure, sure.
They looked at me as if to say, "Why are you talking about this? Nobody here cares about this, right?" And I did it for such a long time, and eventually I thought, "I'm just doing it because if this doesn't ever work, I'll have to kill myself because I've committed so much time to doing this over and over again." In the end, it was like an epiphany. I came back one night from a gig where I died on my ass doing it. And I thought, you know what, man, the tiger thing's got to go. But just to give you an idea of how pathetic I am, it still sits in my phone notebook of potential ideas, waiting for the day when my comedy chops are sufficiently sophisticated that I can bring it back. And listen, when you see me at Madison Square Gardens, doing the Tiger Escape Tour, you'll know it came from this moment.
Is there a recording of this anywhere out there?
If I can find it, I'll email it to you.
Please do.
And then you can put it on the thing.
I'm
happy for you to put the routine up.
That would
be
amazing. Do you know, there's something that doesn't come up often enough because I never have anybody here who's done Edinburgh, but is it frustrating to you to ditch the material you've worked on for a whole year after you've done it at this one place?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think it is horrible.
Yeah.
Like, because the truth is, I don't think I'll ever go back to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Really?
And that is, I'm speaking from the position of somebody who the festival's been very good to.
Sure.
You know, like, I've got a lot of good stuff off the back of the festival, and, you know, I got a lot of opportunities from people seeing me at the festival. But, when I first started doing stand-up, I thought that the Edinburgh Festival, what I wanted it to be was, you write an hour, you play with it, and it makes you a better comedian. And all of those things are true.
Mm-hmm.
The downside of it is that you are under the spotlight to an intense degree. You're being reviewed every day.
Oh, yeah.
And something you've worked on. So I'll give you an example. So what started put me on this negative relationship with Edinburgh is, I did my show, my first show in Edinburgh in 2013, and that was my first ever hour. So that's all, I'm trawling the notebooks, pulling together all this shit. And I had a terrible year in the run-up to that. I was thinking about giving up comedy, and I managed to put this hour together, and I went and did the show, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I got nominated for Best Newcomer. I didn't win. John Kearns won, and he's very good. But fuck him. So I got nominated for Best Newcomer. And I wasn't reading reviews because psychologically I just thought, I don't want to look at reviews. I just want to do the show and have a nice month.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an article about the Fringe, and it said, the nominations are a great list this year, with one exception, Ramesh Ranganathan. I've got no idea how he got nominated for Best Newcomer. This journalist from The Guardian, I'm not going to name names, but it was Brian Logan from The Guardian, said this. And it broke my heart. And I remember thinking to myself, I've worked so hard on it. And everybody, what you got to remember when you go to Edinburgh is, even the shittest show that you see, the worst show where you're angry with the person for taking an hour of your life, they've worked their ass off on
it.
Of course,
do you
know what I mean?
And
that's the thing about Edinburgh, is it's like, if you don't take that show to tour, and because you're not going to make money from Edinburgh. Very few acts make money in Edinburgh. They lose, most lose money. if you then finish your month and you've not got an opportunity off the back of it, or you're not going to tour, it feels like a massive waste of time.
Of course,
do you know what I mean? You've got better as a comic,
yeah,
but there are cheaper ways to get better as a comic. You book a load of nights, a load of gigs near where you live, mm-hmm, and just do that, and don't stay in Edinburgh where the property is really overpriced for the month and all that.
Yeah, of course.
So you just do, you just stay where you are. So it's a very difficult thing, and that's why I think you've seen, I don't know if you're aware, but a lot of comedians at Edinburgh have started to move away from the paid venues.
Okay.
And started doing free shows or pay what you want shows.
All right.
Where you don't pay for the venue, you do a bucket collection, or you pay like a nominal fee of a few hundred pounds to do it. That's not nominal, but do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's much cheaper than doing the paid venues.
Yeah.
And then you take a collection and you do it that way because it costs so much money to do it at the big venues.
Right.
And then you end up, you spent a year writing a show, mm-hmm, you do it for a month, you might not have got what you wanted out of the end of it, and
yep,
then you're charged £5,000. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think it's a really tricky one. A lot of comedians have a difficult relationship with it. And a lot of comedians love it.
Sure.
There's a lot of people that are addicted to it, and,
yeah, yeah,
and fair play to them. If you're doing it and you love it just for the love of doing it, then fair play to you.
Right. I mean, that would be part of your year. That'd be one of the things you look
at. Exactly,
like this,
yeah,
weird working vacation that,
yes,
costs you a shitload of money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can you monetize the, I'm sorry, this is getting like way too deep into baseball, but like, can you monetize the stuff you, can you just record a show and release the damn thing as an album,
yeah,
at least?
Yeah, and there's a comedian, a newer British comedian, who took the money that he would have spent on Edinburgh and just recorded and put out himself,
right,
his show.
Yeah.
That's what he's planning on doing. And you can do that. And a lot of people do that, and they've tried to do that more and more because people are, because what the truth is, if you've worked your ass off on this show,
mm-hmm,
and the other thing is about Edinburgh is, people make up their minds, I think, and like, I'm sure people disagree with me about this, but my impression of Edinburgh is that people make up their minds about what the hot shows are,
mm-hmm,
week one, middle of week two, by,
sure,
the end of week one, middle of week two. If you're not in that bunch, you then go, okay, I've not got a hot show in Edinburgh, but I do have to do the rest of the month.
Yeah.
So you are then in this sort of cycle of depression where like you're sort of thinking, I'm doing the show, and then you're doing it for the enjoyment of the people that are coming to watch you, and the, just the joy of performing. So that, but then at the end of it, you've got to think, well, what do I, what else do I get out of this? How, mm-hmm, do I, if I'm proud of the show, what do I do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when exactly what you're talking about. You've got to, you put it out for free, or,
yeah,
you put a nominal charge in it and try and scrape back some of the money, or,
mm-hmm,
you go, I hope I get on a TV to do a short spot,
sure,
and I've got material now that I can pick and choose from to do that. You,
mm-hmm,
know, that's what a lot of comics do. They write their hour and then they cannibalize it for TV or,
mm-hmm,
various bits and pieces. But not everybody's in that privileged position,
right?
So it's a really difficult one. I think it's tough. Like you said, it's like the point that you sort of made earlier when I unfavorably compared myself to Flip Wilson, where you said it's 2017. You've got to rise above. You know, you've got so much more to fight your way past,
mm-hmm,
if you like. That's the problem with Edinburgh. You know, what,
yeah,
do you do to sort of like make that happen? And that's part of the problem with Edinburgh. You've got thousands and thousands of shows to see.
Mm-hmm.
Why the shit should anybody... I don't know why people would come to my show. So God knows how I can convince other people that it's a good idea. Do you know what I mean?
Is there... Have you in any way spread the word of Flip Wilson amongst people that you hang out with, perform,
yes,
with?
There's a mate of mine in the UK. So a lot of my friends in the UK think that I'm overly obsessed with American stand-up. They,
uh-huh,
think that they're like, so to give you an example, when I said I'm going over to America to try my hand at, they go, of course you are. You're obsessed with it. You think they're so much better than us,
uh-huh,
don't you? But there's one friend of mine who is obsessed with American stand-up as I am, and I've told him about Flip Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be honest with you, he didn't have as positive a response to it as I did.
Sure.
He gets why I recommended it, but he was just like, yeah, I sort of sent it to him and said, just let me know.
Mm-hmm.
And he just came back and went, yeah, I heard it.
Yeah.
It was good.
It's hard to impress an English person.
Yes.
Am I incorrect? Yeah. So,
no.
I mean, that's fine.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I've talked about this a lot. The first half of this year, not even half, I'm being generous, I tried hard to listen to a comedy album a day. That was a thing I was going to do this year.
Right.
That has not happened. That will not finish,
okay,
at this point. I've committed to not doing it now.
Okay.
And that's
well
because,
done for making
thank
that
you
commitment.
So
that's
much.
Really
yeah,
impressive.
Right? I mean, just simply saying it. You can see, I've got 500 albums maybe. That was the whole point, is get rid of the ones that
how
weren't
happen,
any good.
By the way?
This, the podcast, is the reason this happened. I was like, I'm a collector now.
Right.
So I'm just going to buy 25-cent albums. And that's what I fucking did to myself. There's three of these maybe that I was given for free by the artist or et cetera. The rest of them I have bought like a fucking idiot. Or then my friends are like, this is now the one thing people can buy me reliably. So again, it's like five, maybe 600
albums. So you're married. We've met your lovely wife.
Yeah, poor woman.
How is she dealing with that?
She's very kind. Right. She's a very sweet, understanding woman. She supports it because she knows if she doesn't, I'll, you know, jump off a building. You know,
right, okay.
Like that. You understand.
Yeah.
But I tried to burn through these albums. That was kind of the reason, so I could make some room.
Right, got you.
And frankly, it's worked because most of the albums I listened to were utter shit.
Right.
Because a lot of them are like local comedians, which is super fun. But I don't know. I've actually been wondering if that... Holy shit, I don't know what I knocked down. I'm wondering if that phenomenon existed much in England before its own stand-up boom, because its own stand-up boom happened obviously a bit later than ours, right?
Yeah, correct.
And so, like, but you could go to local comedians and you get their albums just at the club that they performed for 30 years, and then, you know, that's the one thing they had. That's how they made some money. It's a shitty record.
Well, I've not only seen that in the UK, but mm-hmm. I've also seen people that have done just anything. So what I mean by that is I've seen people selling books that they've written, mm-hmm. not even comedy books, just short stories.
Okay.
They've gone like, if you've enjoyed what you've seen tonight, I'll be at the back selling a book of short stories.
Uh-huh.
But you can get shows that people put out. It's a double-edged sword because mm-hmm. like now we're in a situation where you can put whatever you want out.
Sure.
You know, you can generate content and you can get it to people. You can't get it to people. You can get it to an access point for people.
Yes. Yeah.
Very, very easily.
Mm-hmm.
There is good and bad in that mm-hmm. because the fact that it's easier means that people don't arguably put out stuff of lower quality because no. they just don't want to get something out there. It's great to get something out there. It's like, I'll get, you know. So I know people like in the UK, and I don't know if it's the case over here in the US, but in the UK, comedians, there is a lot of talk, you know, obviously the talk of it not really being a meritocracy. And I mm-hmm. don't think it is. People get lucky. And
sure.
I think that for me, the UK comedy circuit, I think that it's a meritocracy up to a point, and then beyond that, you get lucky or you don't. Do you know what I mean? So there's this like, but I think the best comedians will always rise to the top, but the best comedians won't necessarily become massive TV stars.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always these arguments about how they're picking and the gatekeepers and stuff like that. The argument for the gatekeepers, to a certain degree,
mm-hmm.
is that there's a quality thing there. Do you know what I mean? And like, if everything comes out, if every single at half an hour of stand-up that everybody'd ever written became made available to the public, then comedy would die. Do you know what I mean? Because you uh-huh. just can't have that happen. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. This is going to sound like I'm really kissing English butt, but please understand, this is the only point of reference I have. There's a sketch on Bit of Fry and Laurie, where, and this was back when television deregulation was about to happen. There's just this whole bit where, let's see, an MP is at a restaurant. Stephen Fry is telling him how happy he is about this bill that he just got passed, that it was all about choice and all about choice, and then comes in later and dumps a bag full of forks, plastic forks, onto his table and says, well, you've got the choice now, don't you? It's very much the same thing.
Right, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just a fucking pool to wade through. And you're absolutely right. If everybody got released, what would we do with it? We wouldn't care.
And so it's sort of difficult to know what the solution is, and I don't mm-hmm. know, and I've probably said stuff that people disagree with, but I'm not that bothered.
That's fine. No one's listening. It's okay. I'm kidding. People will listen. Well, okay, so you've already kind of done such a great job of recommending it, but let's say nobody's ever heard of Flip Wilson, or they only know him from appearances on panel shows back here when they existed, like game shows and stuff. What's a good reason to listen to this album maybe as a first shot for him?
I think the reason that you should listen to this album is, I think in terms of the craft of the stand-up on this album, it is ahead of its time. And I think that it's one of the few albums from that period that you could listen to now. And I'm not necessarily saying it holds its own against contemporary stand-up,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's aged incredibly well.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, if you want to be impressed by a level of craft that belies the period in which it was made, mm-hmm. then this is a great album to listen to.
That's perfect. Again, where can people find you online? And then please promote the show again.
You can, RameshRanganathan.com is my website. At RameshRanga is my Twitter. and then at Rom Ranger, I think. Oh, no, at Romish Ranger again for Instagram.
All right.
I'm not on Snapchat. I am on Snapchat, but it's a defunct account that I don't know the password for anymore. So I wouldn't recommend you look me up on there.
Uh-huh.
And tickets are available. I think there's only about two or three tickets left now.
Mm-hmm.
And by two or three, I mean 2,000 or 3,000
mm-hmm.
tickets left.
Sure.
For my show. More than that, actually. I'm not, even as I said that joke, I was understating how many tickets there are left to sell at the Greek Theatre on the 21st of December. But yeah, feel free to buy a ticket and come.
That's amazing. Thank cool. you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, man.
That
I appreciate
was
it.
Amazing. Thank you guys for listening. Just go to stolendress.com. And actually, you know what? December 2nd, come see me perform in Scrooged, a live stage show, because this is going to come out before then. Yeah, of course it will. Yeah, so come see that, a drinking game at Acme Hollywood. Well, that's about it. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.